Good afternoon. My name is Maria. That's the easiest part, right? Maria Hamlin. And today our session is going to be about health. Health as a human right and a community responsibility. But first let's get acquainted with one another. Can you tell us where you're from? What your name is?
Darren Mott from Puyallup, Washington.
Darren from Puyallup and Boston, basically. Mm-hmm.
Ken Peterson from Anchorage.
Rob Burgess from Anchorage.
Jeff Lindgren, Rocky, Illinois.
John Dino from Cheney, Washington.
Nancy Hausler from Holden Village.
Carol Reed, Forest Service Holden Village.
Jenny Whitson, Manchester Village.
Allison Swan, St. Paul, Minnesota.
Jennifer Morales from Springfield, Oregon.
Susan Corey, Thousand Oaks, California.
Martin King, Ithaca, New York.
Lynn Reed, Oldsburg, Washington.
Okay, well, we have the Northwest represented fairly well. Some of the people here from Alaska. What I would like to do is get you to tell me what you think of when you see this word. Just anybody.
Big bucks.
Big bucks.
Personal well-being. Physically fit. Mm-hmm.
Quality of life.
Quality of life.
Insurance. Yeah, that's up there with the business.
Anything else?
Doctor.
Hospitals.
The other thing I think of is not just the absence of disease.
Anything else come to your mind?
Medicine.
Politics.
Do you spell that?
Help. Oh, okay. Just I-N-G, A-G-I-N-G.
A-G-I-N-G.
English is much harder to write than Spanish.
Injections.
Okay. Well, I think we have some people in this room who have thought about this topic before. One thing that's interesting is that that a lot of people, when we do this, when we talk about health, think of what is your name?
Rob.
Rob said here, it's not just the absence of disease. A lot of people think that that's what it is. Or we tend to think of health in terms of ourselves, personal, individual health. And having physical, nobody said anything about mental health, but maybe that comes in quality. The World Health Organization has a definition of health that a lot of people use who are working in health. It's physical, mental, and social well-being. But whose physical, mental, and social well-being? No? Other people, when they think of health, actually think of doctors and hospitals and medicines and injection. Yeah. Doctors, hospitals, and medicine. But is that health? You're shaking your head. What is that?
Well, it's the absence of health, I guess. Hoping to be healthy, maybe. Mm-hmm. Physically healthy.
Yes. But it's sickness, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And so we call these health care institutions. No? Mm-hmm. But what they really are sickness care institutions and not health care. Mm-hmm. It's sort of like they want us to think that you get health by having doctors or medicine or hospitals available to you. Isn't that sort of what you think? You go to the doctor because you're sick and you want to get well. But he's taking care of a sick person. Not all doctors, but when most people think of doctors or hospitals, they think to go there because they're sick. When the World Health Organization talks about physical, mental, and social well-being, they also talk about a goal that was set. It was set back in, about 1975, at a meeting of the World Health Organization that took place in Russia, in the Soviet Union. And at that time, they talked about health for all by the year 2000 as a goal. Do they talk about that in your health service, Rob? Do you ever?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Rob works in Alaska in health service. And we'll see that we have some similarities in our work. Well, the World Health Organization, which is an organization of representatives of health ministries from all over the world, from all the countries that conform to the United Nations, they began to talk about health for all by the year 2000. And some of us who are progressive health workers have begun to talk about health for nobody in the year 2000. Mm-hmm. Why would there be that dichotomy between what health ministries are saying and what progressive health workers are saying? Do you have any ideas? It's up here on the board.
Dollars.
Dollars and what else?
Politics.
Dollars and politics. Hmm? Because there's a business around health services. Hospitals, insurance, doctors, all of this requires big bucks, and it also makes big bucks, isn't that right? Mm-hmm. For somebody, but not for the majority. Well, let's keep these things in mind, and let's try to look at what some of us talk about when we talk about health. There's a tendency, in most cases, to think of health as being this perfect state over here. But what is health really? It's a continuum, no? Between sickness on this end, and wellness. But what can define this continuum? Can we be anywhere along this line in any particular moment? Can I be physically well and not mentally well? Can I have physical well-being but live in a social situation that is not conducive to the health of my community? We have to make a distinction between individuals and a community. Now, a lot of health care is provided to individuals. And one of the problems that we have in this country is the tendency to see ourselves as individuals seeking health care from the medical system, the medical establishment. But if our communities are not healthy, then we can't really be healthy. For example, this community was a mining community. There were workers that worked in the mine, and there were workers that worked outside of the mine. Probably those that worked in the mine were exposed to situations that caused problems with their lungs. Let's just assume that, okay? Because people who work in mines often do not have protection for working in the mines, and they become ill, their lungs become affected by this, and that affects their health individually, but it also affects what happens in their community. Can somebody tell me how it can affect what happens in the community?
Because of the purpose of the mine is to, for the village, if the miners aren't there, then the village won't be there.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Or, how, in what other ways? If somebody becomes sick, do you think the mine is going to stop? Will the mine stop? If one, or two, or three?
If a whole bunch of them.
Well, what do you think would happen if somebody came sick in the mine? Would the mine stop?
No.
What would they do?
Replace him.
They would replace him. And if the company didn't have insurance, as many companies around the world don't, no. When somebody becomes sick and has to leave, there is usually, in poor countries of the world, no workman's compensation. They leave, somebody else comes, and in a few years, the lungs of those people are also infected by whatever it is that they have in the mind, right? Usually what happens is people develop tuberculosis, but the tuberculosis develops because of the different metals that get into their lungs and so on. In the house where I live up here, there's a sign on the door that says, on the door to the basement, that says there are dangerous particles in the dust in this basement because there's asbestos. I was really surprised to see that sign on the door. Mm-hmm. That's because here people are conscious of environmental problems. No? Somebody knows that if you breathe asbestos dust, that it goes into your lungs and it never comes out. No? And it causes serious problems. So somebody was conscious of that. But there are many people living in buildings or in houses that are made with asbestos fibers. And if there's not a ceiling that separates, for example, the roof from the people, then people are always breathing in that dust. And they live in a hazardous house. But many times people don't know they live in hazardous houses. No? Do you get the idea of what I'm getting at? So we can have individuals that may be anywhere along this continuum in any of the different kinds of ways of looking at health. Physical. And I would like to put another one here that wasn't mentioned by the World Health Organization at that time, but it's the environmental. Because that has become more and more important to us in the last few years. When I went to the University of Minnesota back in, for my graduate school in 1960, there was not a section of occupational health and safety. And now that's a really important part of the study of public health. It's a new field in public health, and I think a very important field. So we can be anywhere along this continuum in any of these different aspects. So we have disabled people, physically disabled people, who may be healthier than a person who is suffering constantly from stress in their job. We may have somebody who's physically disabled who is in better shape overall, better health overall, than somebody who works in Detroit in a factory that's going to close down in a few months. Because that person is in a mental state and a socioeconomic condition that is not conducive to their health. So what I want to do is help you come to an understanding of the continuum upon which all of us and are living and which determines our health in any moment in time. Okay? Is that clear? Any problem with that? So, what do we have to do if we're health workers? Health workers have to be conscious of this continuum. And we have to be conscious as well that health is not an individual matter. Now, we live in a society that's highly individualistic in terms of health care. You don't hear about people going, you hear about doctors going into specialties where they're dealing with very sophisticated kinds of things. People go into neurosurgery, people go into plastic surgery, they go into obstetrics and gynecology, they go into pediatrics. They become very specialty oriented for the individual. No? But there's also that part of medicine, that part of health, public health, that is community oriented, that sees the community as the patient, if you will, no? And is interested in diagnosing what's happening to the community. Because what happens to a collective of individuals is what's going on in the community. And if we don't have healthy communities, we don't really have healthy people. Would you agree with me, Rob?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Now, most of our medical practice, most of the medical establishment is directed toward the individual and not toward the community. This is the area which is, it's prestigious to be a person working in this medical establishment. It's not prestigious to work in community health, in public health. But this is probably the most important, and especially if here we're Christian people concerned with what's happening to our neighbors, then we should be interested in what's happening in community health. And those of us in community health learn that there are not just single causes of disease, but that there are many. When we analyze the situation in our in an individual and do a diagnosis, what is it that we look for? We have a nurse here. Are there other nurses or doctors?
Symptoms.
Hmm?
Symptoms.
Yes, we look at symptoms. What else? What do we do with the patient when they come in?
History.
History.
Physical exam, observable.
Physical? Physical and what else? What's included in that?
Vital signs.
Yeah. Well, I'll put it down. It's a laboratory exam.
Yeah.
And we try to find the cause. And most people, when they talk about the causes of disease, what kind of causes do they talk about?
Physical.
Physical causes.
Physical causes? Like what?
Injuries.
Disease.
But when we talk about diseases, what are the causes of diseases?
Like an infection could be one.
Infection, for example?
Pneumonia.
Okay. Bacterial.
Bacterial, viral.
Yes. Bacteria and virus are biological causes of disease. So we look at physical causes, no, an accident, for example, trauma, or biological. But do we look at the social causes of disease in the medical establishment? Most of the time, we don't do that, no, because the medical establishment is set up in such a way that it attempts to have people see themselves in an individual way, and it stresses the biological causes of illness. But if we really start to analyze what's happening in our communities, we'll discover that biological causes usually have other causes. No? So I'm going to share with you a little bit the experience that I have as a health worker for the last 25 years or so, working in Central America. We do this kind of work with the people with whom we are working in Central America. We try to work with communities and help them come to an understanding of this continuum, which is sickness and health. No. Instead of just thinking of a static state to which people ideally want to arrive. No. So that people realize that they can have a certain degree of wellness within the difficult situations in which they live. Do you think that it's easy, for example, for displaced people who are living in refugee camps to think that they can have some degree of wellness? Well, you don't, but they try to arrive at that because they try to understand the continuum and the causes. And the fact that they can't be completely healthy because they're not in their homes. They're in exile. And they're in situations of maybe poor sanitation, living in crowded conditions and so on. And so there are lots of things they can't have. But how can they make of that situation something which has some quality of life for them that's acceptable? Because if they can do that, they can cope with that situation much better than they could if they just feel that, you know, it's so bad that there's no way that we can live here. When there's not the will to live, then people are going to lose their lives. No, they're not going to be able to fight off infection even though they have antibiotics. So let me give you an idea of what we do. For the last 20 years or so, I've been working, organizing what are called community-based health programs and working with the training of village-level or community-level health workers. These workers, these volunteers in many cases, are village or neighborhood people. In many cases, they have less than 4 years of formal education. In fact, in Guatemala, the average education for the people with whom we have been working is about third grade formal education in the Spanish language. But in many cases, as in Guatemala, the people with whom we work do not have Spanish as their first language. They are indigenous people. And so they have their own language. They have their own culture. They have their own way of looking at the world. They have their own idea of what health is for them. And that's one of the reasons that we began to work with village-level health workers. Many of us in the 60s were working in clinics or in hospitals. We were, when I say many of us, we were expatriates, if you will. We were foreigners working in health programs in Central America. And these programs were, in most cases, church-related programs. About 90% of them were church-related programs. Some were non-governmental programs that were non-sectarian. And there were hospitals, and there were clinics, and there were doctors and nurses. But what happened, every single day, you'd have 50 to 100 people outside waiting to see the doctor. And that would happen day after day. And you keep track of the patients because you had their histories like you're supposed to have, their cards. And they would come back, and they would come back, and they would come back. And so some people began to really question what was going on. First of all, was this really proper health care for the situation in which we were living? Well, in different places, more or less at the same time, there developed what came to be called health promoters or village health workers. Most of these programs were working in rural areas, and so we talk about villages, but this has been translated to urban situations. So it's not entirely urban, but at the beginning it was mostly rural. I mean, entirely rural, but at the beginning it was mostly rural. And so it was felt that if we began to train people who were from communities, had their origins there, spoke the language, understood the culture, that we could teach them, work with them, and help them to come to an understanding of what could be done for the people in their communities within their cultural framework, not within ours, within their cultural framework. And so the training of these health promoters began. And there are some very well-known programs, and there's some less well-known ones. But it was early, it was in the mid-60s that this kind of work began in Central America. And in some countries, it became the major health service that was available to people in rural communities. In Guatemala, where I lived and worked for a while, there was no public health service that worked in the rural communities. About 90% of all medical personnel who graduated from medical school or nursing school in Guatemala, in El Salvador, in Nicaragua, worked in the capital city or the largest cities of the country. Well, there are not very many large cities in countries like Guatemala or Nicaragua. You know, maybe two major cities, and all the rest are small rural communities. Doctors and nurses wouldn't go there. Nurses were not trained for public health. Nurses were trained to assist doctors in hospitals. And so what you had was the support of these medical institutions and the vast majority of the people with no access to those institutions and no outreach. So what we were trying to do was to develop outreach programs. People then would come in for their training programs, both village health workers and midwives. They would come in for the training programs, they would return to their community, and they would have various aspects of health that they would work on in their communities. They would learn how to identify symptoms and treat those symptoms. No? Because in most cases they wouldn't have access to laboratory services. But what kinds of diseases do we have in our poor countries of the world? We have diseases that no longer exist in the developed world, because what do you have that we don't have? What do you think that you have here that we don't have in poor countries of the world? The most basic thing.
Water.
For health. It's water. Potable water is available. 100 years ago, when potable water was not available in this country, in some places, there were sicknesses that we have in the poor countries of the world. But basically, many of the problems that we have are waterborne diseases, diarrhea. Children die of diarrhea. Children die of upper respiratory infections, of pneumonias, because of the housing conditions. So we go back to the social causes of illness. No, we don't have basic public services in the poor countries of the world, neither water or sewage disposal. So we're dealing with problems that if communities have education programs established, then they, the people themselves, can take responsibility for what happens in their communities. Now, we'll get into whether that's the community's responsibility or that's the state's responsibility. We believe that the state has responsibility for providing certain services, the state or the city or the government, no? I mean, you aren't going to go out and dig a well in Peoria, no? I don't think. What oaks?
Thousand oaks.
Or
Dallas or Boston.
You aren't going to go out and dig a well in your backyard, are you? Would they even let you? No, of course not. And could you have an outhouse in your backyard? No. Does anybody know? Can you build latrines in your backyard? Well, maybe you live out in the countryside. So that's not fair. But in normal cities, there are sanitary codes, no? And so you don't, you have water supplied to you by the government, by your local government or whatever, and you have sewer systems and you have collection of garbage and all of those things. We don't have those things in the majority of the poor countries of the world because money is not spent for that. We'll get into that maybe later this week about how budgets are determined for health in the poor countries of the world. But we don't have those, and that's why we have so many illnesses that are really preventable. So we work with the health promoters, as we call them, and they learn how to identify and treat common diseases. They learn the importance of and promote vaccination programs. Now, if the vaccines are available for the programs. Just one thing that some of us have tried to ensure. And the other thing is that the promoters learn, as part of their training, the importance of working with the person and their family and the community to resolve problems. That the person's degree of wellness or illness doesn't depend just on them, but what happens in the community. And so the community begins to organize and organizes itself around issues like the installation of water, no, or the disposal of garbage, or the need to build latrines, latrine programs, no, so that people can have an environment which is more conducive to better health, but their community responses. So we'll try to discuss a little bit about who has responsibility for health. Who do you think has responsibility for the health of people? What do you think? Well, you?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we all have responsibility for our health. Why do people smoke then?
Good
question. Or why do people eat too much or eat the wrong things? Well, some people do that because they don't know any better, right? But some people make a conscious decision to do that, to do or to act in ways that are not conducive to individual health. But what about if we're talking about the health of the community? Who has the responsibility for community health?
Community government.
The community government. Is that what you said? Uh-huh. And how would that work?
Public health nurses.
Public health nurses. Well, not all places have public health nurses. Well, there are public health programs. There are public health programs, especially in developed countries, in first world countries, as we call them. But in the third world, there are not very many public health programs that reach out, and that's why we started these programs. But what we try to do is help people come to an understanding that health is not a privilege. As somebody said before, yeah. Health is not a privilege. And we believe that health is not a privilege. We believe that health is a right of all people. And so health becomes even much more a political issue because we're talking about people's rights, where people can make demands, where they can pressure their governments. And what has happened in countries like Guatemala or Salvador, Nicaragua, is that when people start identifying the real causes of illness, not just illness in individuals, but illness in their communities, and understand that health is a right, not a privilege, it's a human right, we all have a right to health, then the work that these health workers are doing becomes subversive. So those of us who train community health workers are subversives. And that's what's happened all through Central America. That's what's happened in the Philippines. That's what's happened in South Africa, in Zimbabwe, in North Africa, in Palestine, and other places where people began to analyze not individual health, not the medical establishment. When people begin to question the medical establishment, question those big bucks, then health becomes a dangerous business. No, because we're saying that health is a right, it's something that we should struggle for, it's something that we should work for, that we believe in, and unfortunately what it has meant is that many people who are health workers are people who have lost their lives in the struggle for the liberation of their countries from systems which are imposing disease and death upon their communities by not permitting the communities to have what we consider to be people's rights. Now, do you think that health is your right? Do you think health is your right? How are you acting out that belief?
By having insurance.
That you're paying for the insurance. Mm-hmm. Do you think that you should be paying for that insurance? You don't. What are you doing about it?
Putting up with it.
Well, anybody else? Anybody else that thinks health is a right? Or is health something that you should pay for?
Perhaps as a community. So that all have access. It has to be paid for somehow.
Yes. It has to be paid for somehow. But who should be paying for it?
The state. Everybody in the community should be paying for it.
No matter who pays for it, it's going to come down to the individual that pays for it. I pay the taxes that are going to pay for it, one way or another.
Seems to me the real question is whether we consider it to be a right for other people to be healthy. I mean, it's not our own individual right, but whether, because I mean, it's thinking about that that then might drive change. Most people in this room probably have health insurance or some access to good health care. And so they may think that it's a right, but that doesn't motivate change because they have that right fulfilled, it would seem to me.
Yes, well, there are many people who don't have access to good health care, and I think that that's becoming a political issue here in the United States where it hasn't before. I remember when I was in public health, one of my teachers for one quarter at the University of Minnesota was the director of the health program in British Columbia. In British Columbia at that time, that was in 1961, 62, that I had this professor, they had socialized medicine in British Columbia. No? And there are people in Canada today who are fighting for their right to continue to have health care available for all people. And some people here in the United States are looking at examples of, quote, socialized medicine, you know, as alternatives for people here in the United States. But you see, when we start talking about, we don't have to call it socialized medicine, because socialism to most people in the United States is a bad word, you know. And so we can talk about people's right to health care, all people's right to health care. Because if we really believe that our health is integrally tied up in the health of our community, then we can't deny the health of other people or the right of other people to access for health care. And in some Canadian provinces, there are changes taking place right now, and people are beginning to struggle to work toward making sure that they don't lose the kind of health care that they have. Well, in the countries that I worked in, they never had it, you know? And so people feel that they have to continue to work toward a way that health is identified as a community, as an individual right, and a community responsibility. Now, I wanted to ask Rob to share with us a little bit about what they're doing in Alaska, because I think that there's a lot of comparisons between what we have tried to do with Native peoples and poor people, rural people in Central America, and what is being done in Canada. Would you like to comment about that?
Yeah, the system that we have in Alaska is the community health aid program, where local people from the communities are trained in taking histories and examining patients and then calling up the referral doctor. So the thing that they have that a lot of other places don't have is that they have a lot of supplies and equipment and medical prescription drugs and so on available. The health aides get into community issues and prevention, and a part of that would be every treatment plan for a patient with an illness. If that person has a respiratory illness and they're smoking at home, then part of the plan would be that there shouldn't be smoking at home, that this is helping to make it worse. Then they can also get into more community activities toward wellness, but most of this model is the medical model in the rest of the United States, so there's not a whole lot of community medicine that they get into by themselves unless they can join with other people who can band together toward helping the community. They can't be the only one person mm-hmm. to do that.
Well, I think that's a very good point. None of us alone can do it, no? I mean, we have to see more and more that if we're going to solve individual problems, that we have to solve overall community problems, you know? And that communities have to take some initiative in this. Do any of you have examples of how communities have done this? Communities that you know?
Well, I was just wondering if you were familiar with the so-called Oregon plan that's been making the papers lately. It was just being formulated as we left home, so I'm not too sure, but it was denied somehow at the national level. It was a plan that would have provided a minimum of health care to everyone in Oregon, except that it set up certain standards of what constitutes health. In other words, cases that were, shall we say, really radical treatment, someone extremely ill who was facing death, unless some miraculous type very expensive thing was applied. So it tried to determine what level of health is desirable for everybody. But it was, I saw in the paper the other day, it was denied as being unconstitutional.
Well, it wasn't unconstitutional, it was denied, it was just denied by the Bush administration.
Yeah. But wasn't that the basis of something?
No, what they said is that they said their feeling was is that because certain individuals such as alcoholics with cirrhosis would not have access, unlimited access to liver transplant, and babies who are below 24 months of age, preterm baby, or premature babies, whose level of whose risk of survival would be less than 5% anywhere, 10%, who would not be, have access to the NALIC security units. And because of that, they gave that as examples, but they felt that that would violate the handicap act that Congress had passed, and therefore they, it was an arbitrary decision that the Bush administration made.
A lot of thought, some work went into this, and it was
I think it was more of a political, I think it was a political decision was made by the Bush administration, more than a really decision based on law.
But given the cost of medication we have, of medicine, we have to, I think, arrive at some level of what constitutes.
But why do medicines cost a lot of money?
Because of drug companies that charge a lot of money.
Exactly. There's a medical establishment.
And doesn't research come somewhere into this? I mean, somebody has to pay for that.
Well, no, it's
malpractice insurance and everything else too gets involved.
Yeah, but this is all part. This is all part of a medical establishment. There are hospitals, there's insurance, there are drug companies. What else might there be?
There's a consumer.
Hospital supply.
Yeah.
Hardware.
The consumer demand.
The consumer's desire to not have anything but the very best for themselves and their family. In other words, they don't settle for something that's in this country for something that's not as good as the top.
Uh-huh. That's what some people have said to us, that we're working in third world countries and we have third class medicine. We don't believe that. No? Because just because you pay more doesn't mean it's the best. Don't let them fool you. Just because you pay more, it's not necessarily the best. Did you want
to? I was just going to ask you that question because I have some friends whose parents, older people, will go to Mexico and buy exactly the same thing they can buy here. I think it's exactly the same thing. And it's half the price.
Yes. Let me tell you some stories. There are drug companies that provide medicines to Lutheran World Relief, to Catholic Relief Services, to the Mennonite Central Committee, to all of these groups. They can buy, for their mission programs overseas, low-cost bulk medicines. When you start figuring it out, and lots of people have worked on it, something that costs a dollar to the consumer here in the United States really costs about 3 cents to develop. Mm-hmm. The rest of it is all overhead, if you will. It's all going to different people or corporations that are involved in this. Remember that these are big corporations that produce pharmaceuticals. But if you go and try to buy in bulk, you can get medicines at this price. If we can get medicines at this price overseas, why can't there be programs here in the United States for people who need medicines at low cost? No? Now, a lot of people don't get this abroad. But let me tell you another story. One of the people who's involved with us in a network of progressive health workers that we were developing is a doctor from Bangladesh. And he set up a national drug-producing company in Bangladesh through the government, and he reduced the cost of all major essential drugs, because there are lots of drugs that are not essential. There are about 250 essential drugs in all the world, but there are, in some countries, up to 20,000, 25,000 brands of drugs. A lot of them are mixtures. Mixtures are not good for people. We don't need them. No? But they cost more and they're pushed. And they're pushed in injectable form because it costs more to give people injections than it does to give them an oral medication. So what this friend did is he developed this drug program and he began to manufacture drugs at very low cost and distributed them through the health system in Bangladesh. And do you know that his life has been threatened repeatedly? The last time was last year. His life is threatened because he's doing something that could happen in other countries of the world if people wanted to duplicate this experience. No, a lot of people won't do it because they're afraid to do it. A lot of people won't do it because they're bought up by the drug companies. Who has the money for his head? Who's providing the money for his death, for his head? It's the drug companies. The same thing happens when we talk about infant formulas. And now not only infant formulas, but also infant baby foods. You see, a lot of drugs are not legal in the United States. There are drugs that are not legal. There are things like infant formulas and infant weaning foods that people here know that are not good to use. And so the producers of these in these countries of the North begin to push them in the South, you know, because they have to sell their products. And so they make their products indispensable for people in the southern part of the world. No? The same thing happens with pesticides. Here in the United States, you can't use DDT, but in my country, DDT can be used now. It couldn't be used during the time of the Sandinistas, but it can be used now. Why? Because the companies dump those products on third world countries because they can't be used anymore here. So if a third world country person begins to develop a program like Safrula is his name, Safrula's program, then he is a dangerous person and he risks his life for doing that. But he's proven that you can provide those medicines at low cost. I'm going to speak on Friday about an experience in the Horn of Africa in a newly liberated country called Eritrea. And I'll share some more about what progressive people are doing there. But I think the important thing to realize is that there's this tremendous medical establishment that makes you believe that you need the very best. But who defines the very best? What is the very best? For you? That very best for you may not be the very best for the person in Alaska who is an Eskimo, who is a native person. It may not be the very best for somebody in Central America. No. The very best medical attention for women in childbirth is not necessarily the hospital. No. And that's why midwifery programs are important. And in the countries where I've worked, especially Guatemala, the midwife is a sacred person. No? She's a sacred person from the time of her birth. A child, a woman who is born with a mantle on her head. And this mantle is nothing more than some of the afterbirth that stays on her head. If a woman is born that way, the midwife who delivers her takes that mantle and she keeps it. And when the woman goes into puberty, she learns that she has been born this way and that she will become a midwife. And many times they will reject that and they will become ill and all sorts of things will happen to them. And eventually they'll have to accept that they're a chosen person. You laugh, but it's true. They're chosen people, and they have to learn then from the old midwives what midwifery is. And most women in those Indian communities would not even think of the alternative of going to a hospital in a town far away from them, in a city where nobody knows them, where somebody strips them of their clothing, puts other clothing on them, takes them into this room with all these lights and green. No? It's just terribly, terribly frightening. And so the midwife, the woman feels that her best possible health care is in her community with her midwife. But what do we do in our work? We help the midwife identify the major symptoms that would be serious problems that would require intervention. And these things don't happen at the last minute. They are symptoms that we can identify early on with proper prenatal care. So the midwives work on prenatal care. If they see these symptoms coming up, they refer that woman to the hospital, to the health center, to somebody with greater medical knowledge than she has. And if, at the time of her delivery, it's necessary, then she will be referred, but she will at least have some preparation for this very alienating, frightening experience that she's going to have in a hospital. How many of you have been in hospitals? Hmm? Well, a good number of you. Did you feel good in the hospital?
No, that's why I was there.
Well, you were sick. But
I was having a baby.
Okay, well, you went to have a baby, but you knew what to expect?
No, the first time, no. I knew what to expect.
But how did you feel then?
Well, apprehension. I mean, what you hear are a lot of horror stories, not necessarily, you know, that it's going to be all right and this is fine and it really isn't anything to be concerned about. But I was apprehensive.
Well, I think none of us likes to go to a hospital. Right? Except somebody who works that's their job. But you understand the anxiety that the patients have, don't you? Mm-hmm. And you're taught to deal with that anxiety and help people. But it's a very, in some ways, dehumanizing experience to have to go to a hospital. Because suddenly you're stripped down to your bareness, no? And most of us don't feel good having that happen to us. So if you can put yourselves into the body of a person who is from another culture, who speaks another language, no? And that happens here in this country just as much as it happens in the countries of the third world, then you can see how important it is that we too, here in this country, try to develop programs where community people can be involved in healthcare and decision-making for healthcare. And many of us feel that the alternatives that we're developing in the third world have application here, in this country, and in the rich countries of the world. But if we're going to talk about the introduction of these kinds of alternatives, we have to deal with this medical establishment. And if we're going to deal with the medical establishment, it means we have to become political activists. And so healthcare isn't just people who want to take care of patients. If we really talk about healthcare, we have to understand the political issues surrounding healthcare. And if we believe health is a right of all people, then I think it follows from that that we have to become, we have to inform ourselves further about what is happening in our communities. Maybe some of your communities are more advanced in this sense than others. Not too many, though. We have to become informed about what's happening in our community, what alternatives are available for people, and what is it that we really can do. And we can't be afraid of recognizing that health is a tremendously political issue. And most of us have not been brought up with that kind of awareness. It's something that we develop through time. No. Health is a tremendously political issue. And health is a right of all people. And there are many people who are struggling, both in the third world and in richer countries of the world, to make people much more aware of this. And so I hope that gives you some food for thought. In the next few days, what I want to do is share with you some of the methodologies that we use in our work. Tomorrow, I'll be talking about child-to-child as a methodology for health education, where children who are young children and have responsibility for their younger siblings become involved in health promotion, in health education. And I will also do something on what we call training for transformation, helping people come have attitude changes. And I will be trying to share what we do and challenge you to think about how this can be applied to what you do in your families, in your communities, in your churches, or whatever. So, thank you very much. Thank you.